Liberty and Its Fruits, a book by Jonathan Edwards, commenced narrating February 8th, 2007, Lecture 6, Charity Inconsistent with an Envious Spirit. Charity envies not, 1 Corinthians 13:4. Having already seen the nature and tendency of Christian charity, or divine love, with respect to the evil received from others, that it suffers long, and also with respect to doing good to others, that it is kind, we now come to the feelings and conduct to which the same charity will lead us in respect to the good possessed by others, and that possessed by ourselves. And in reference to the good possessed by others, the Apostle declares that be the nature and tendency of charity or true Christian love not to envy them the possession of any good whatever which is theirs. Charity envieth not. The teaching of these words plainly is that charity, or a truly Christian spirit, is the very opposite of an envious spirit. In dwelling on that thought, I would show, 1, what is the nature of an envious spirit? 2, wherein a Christian spirit is the opposite of such a spirit, and 3, the reason and evidence of the doctrine. 1, the nature of envy. Envy may be defined to be a spirit of dissatisfaction with, and the opposition to, the prosperity and happiness of others as compared with our own. The thing that the envious person is opposed to and dislikes is the comparative superiority of the state of honor or prosperity or happiness that another may enjoy over that which he possesses. And the spirit is especially called envy when we dislike and are opposed to another's honor or prosperity, because in general it is greater than our own, or because in particular they have some honor or enjoyment that we have not. It is a disposition natural in men that they love to be uppermost, and this disposition is directly crossed when they see others above them. And it is from this spirit that men dislike and are opposed to the prosperity of others, because they think it makes those who possess it superior in some respect to themselves. And from the same disposition, a person may dislike another being equal to himself in honor or happiness, or in having the same sources of enjoyments that he has. For as men very commonly are, they cannot bear a rival much, if any, better than a superior, for they love to be singular and alone in their eminence and advancement. Such a spirit is called envy in the Scripture. Thus Moses speaks of Joshua's envying for his sake, when Eldad and Medad were admitted to the same privilege with himself, and having the spirit of prophecy given them, saying, Numbers 11:29, "Enviest thou for my sake? Would God that all the Lord's people were prophets, and that the Lord would put his spirit upon them." And Joseph's brethren, we are told in Genesis 34:11, envied him when they had heard his dream, which implied that his parents and brethren were yet to bow down before him, and that he was to have power over them. From such a spirit, persons are not only unwilling that others should be above them or equal to them, but that they should be near them, for the desire to be distinguished in prosperity and honor is the more gratified just in proportion as they are elevated and others are below them, so that their comparative eminence may be marked and visible to all. And this disposition may be exercised either in reference to the prosperity that others may obtain and of which they are capable, or in reference to that which they actually have obtained. In the latter form, which is a more common, the feeling of envy will be manifest in two respects. First, in respect to their prosperity, and next, in respect to themselves. 1, it will be manifest in an uneasiness and dissatisfaction with the prosperity of others. Instead of rejoicing in the prosperity of others, the envious man will be troubled with it. It will be a grievance to his spirit to see them rise so high and come to such honors and advancement. It is no comfortable feeling to him to hear of their having obtained such and such advantages and honors and preferments, but on the contrary, very uncomfortable. He is very much of the spirit of Haman, who, in view of all the glory of his riches and the multitude of his children and all the things wherein the king had promoted him, still could say, Esther 5:13, "Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting in the king's gate." From such a spirit, the envious person stands ready to rejoice at anything that happens to diminish the honor and comfort of others. He is glad to see them brought down, and will even study how to lower their estate, as Haman did, how to humble and bring down Mordecai. and often like him, and he will show his uneasiness not only by planning and scheming, but by actual endeavors of one kind or another to bring them down. And the very first opportunity of pulling them down that offers, he will gladly embrace. And it is from this disposition that the sight even of others' prosperity often sets the envious on talking against them and speaking evil of them, even when perhaps they do not know them. Envying them the prominence they have obtained, they hope by speaking evil of them in some measure to diminish their honors and lower them in the esteem of men. This suggests, again, number two, that the opposition of the envious to the prosperity of others will be manifest in a dislike of their persons for it. Seeing how others prosper and what honors they attain, the envious dislike and even hate them on account of their honor and prosperity. They entertain and cherish an evil spirit toward them for no other reason but that they are prospered. They are embittered against them in spirit only because they are eminent in name or fortune. Thus Haman, it is said in Esther 5:9, was full of indignation against Mordecai because he saw him in the king's gate and because he stood not up nor moved for him. And Joseph's brethren, Genesis 37:4-5, hated him and could not speak peaceably to him because his father loved him. And when he had dreamed a dream implying their inferiority, they hated him yet the more. And so the envious generally resent the prosperity of others and their coming to honor as if in it they were guilty of some injury to themselves. Sometimes there is a settled hatred toward others upon this account, leading, as in the case of Joseph's brethren in Genesis 37:19-28, to acts of the greatest cruelty and wickedness, but this may suffice for the nature of this envy. And I proceed to show section 2, wherein a Christian spirit is the opposite of such a spirit of envy. Number 1. A Christian spirit disallows of the exercise and expressions of such a spirit. He that is influenced in the course of his life and actions by Christian principles, though he may have envy as well as other corrupt feelings in his heart, yet abhors its spirit as unbecoming in himself as a Christian, and contrary to the nature and will and spirit of God. He sees it to be a most odious and hateful spirit, and he sees its odiousness not only in others, but also unequally in himself. And therefore, whenever he perceives its emotions rising within him on any occasion or toward any person, so far as he is influenced by a Christian spirit, he will be alarmed at it and will fight against it and will not allow its exercise for a moment. He will not suffer it to break forth and show itself in words or actions, and he will be grieved at whatever he sees of its movements in his heart and will crucify within him the hateful disposition and do all in his power to go contrary to it in his outward actions. Number 2. A Christian spirit not only opposes the exercise and outward expressions of an envious spirit, but it tends to mortify its principle and disposition in the heart. So far as a Christian spirit prevails, it not only checks the outward actings of envy, but it tends to mortify and subdue the very principle itself in the heart, so that, just in proportion to the power of the former, the individual will cease to feel any inclination to be grieved at the prosperity of others, and still more will cease to dislike them or entertain any ill will toward them on account of it. A Christian spirit disposes us to feel content with our own condition and with the estate which God has given us among men, and to a quietness and satisfaction of spirit with regard to the allotments and distributions of stations and possessions which God in his wise and kind providence has made to ourselves and others. Whether our rank be as high as that of the angels or as low as that of the beggar at the rich man's gate, Luke 16:20, we shall equally be satisfied with it as the post in which God has placed us, and shall equally respect ourselves if we are endeavoring faithfully to serve him in it. Like the apostle in Philippians 4:11, we shall learn, if we do but have a Christian spirit, in whatsoever state we are therewith to be content. But number 3. A Christian spirit not only disallows the exercise and expression of envy and tends to mortify its principle and disposition in the heart, but it disposes us to rejoice in the prosperity of others. It disposes us to a cheerful and habitual compliance with that rule given by the apostle, Romans 12:15, that we rejoice with them that do rejoice and weep with them that weep. In other words, that we sympathize with their estate and condition in the spirit we should feel if it were our own. Such a spirit of benevolence and goodwill will cast out the evil spirit of envy and enable us to find happiness in seeing our neighbor prospered. I now proceed as proposed to show, number 3, the reason and evidence of the doctrine stated, or to show that it is so and why it is so, that a Christian spirit is thus the opposite of a spirit of envy. And this will appear if we consider 3 things. First, how much a spirit in practice contrary to an envious spirit is insisted on in the precepts that Christ has given. Second, how much the history and doctrines of the gospel hold forth to enforce these precepts. And third, how much a spirit of Christian love will dispose us to yield to the authority of these precepts and the influence of the motives enforcing them. Number 1. A spirit in practice entirely contrary to an envious spirit is much insisted on in the precepts of Christ. The New Testament is full of precepts of goodwill to others, and of precepts enjoining the principles of meekness, humility, and beneficence, all of which are opposed to a spirit of envy. And in addition to these, we have many particular warnings against envy itself. The Apostle exhorts in Romans 13:13 that we walk honestly as in the day, not in strife and envying. And again in 1 Corinthians 3:3, he blames the Corinthians as being yet carnal because there was envy in among them. And still again in 2 Corinthians 12:20, he mentions his fears concerning them, lest he should find among them envyings, and that too coupled as envyings too often are, with wraths, strifes, backbitings, whisperings, swellings, tumults. And again in Galatians 5:21, envy is ranked among the abominable works of the flesh, such as murders, drunkenness, revelings, and so on. And again in 1 Timothy 6:4, it is condemned as implying great wickedness. And again in Titus 3:3, it is mentioned as one of the hateful sins that Christians had lived in before their conversion, but which they are now redeemed from, and therefore should confess and forsake. And in the same spirit, the Apostle James in 3:14-16 speaks of envy as exceeding contrary to Christianity, and is connected with every evil work, being earthly, sensual, devilish. And he warns us against it. Verse 9, saying, "Grudge not one against another, brethren, lest ye be condemned. Behold, the judge standeth before the door." And to quote but one more instance, the Apostle Peter in 1 Peter 2:1-2 warns us against all envies as connected with various other evils and as preventing our growth in divine things. Thus we see that the New Testament is full of precepts which Christ has left us, which enjoin the very opposite of the spirit of envy. And these precepts, number 2, are strongly enforced by the doctrines and history of the gospel. If we consider the Christian scheme of doctrine, we shall find that it tends strongly to enforce the precepts we have considered. For all of it, from beginning to end, strongly tends to the contrary of an envious spirit. In all its bearings and teachings, the Christian form of doctrine militates against the spirit of envy. The things it teaches as to God are exceeding contrary to it. For there we are told how far God was from begrudging us the most exceeding honor and blessedness, and how he has withheld nothing as too much to be done for us, or as too great or good to be given us. He has not begrudged us his only begotten and well-beloved Son, who is dearer to him than everything beside. Nor hath he begrudged us the highest honor and blessedness in and through him. The doctrines of the gospel also teach us how far Christ was from begrudging us anything that he could do for or give us. He did not begrudge us a life spent in labor and suffering, or his own precious blood which he shed for us on the cross. Nor will he begrudge us a throne of glory with him in the heavens, where we shall live and reign forever with him. The Christian scheme of doctrines teaches us how Christ came into the world to deliver us from the power of Satan's envy toward us. For the devil, with miserable baseness, envied mankind a happiness that they at first had, and could not bear to see them in their happy state in Eden, and therefore exerted himself to the utmost for their ruin, which he accomplished. And the gospel also teaches how Christ came into the world to destroy the works of the devil and deliver us from that misery into which his envy has brought us, and to purify our natures from every trace of the same spirit that we may be fitted for heaven. And if, in addition to the doctrine of the gospel, we consider its history, we shall find that it also tends greatly to enforce those precepts that forbid envy. And particularly is this true of the history of the life of Christ in the example he has set us. How far was he from a spirit of envy? How contented in the low and afflictive circumstances in which he voluntarily placed himself for our sakes? And how far was he from envying those that were of worldly wealth and honor, or coveting their condition? He rather chose to continue in his low estate, and when the multitude, filled with admiration of his teaching and his miracles, on one occasion stood ready to make him a king, he refused the high honor they intended to put upon him, and withdrew himself to be out of their way. John 6:15, and went away into a mountain alone. And when John the Baptist was so greatly honored by the people as a distinguished prophet, and all Judea and Jerusalem went out to hear him and to be baptized of him, Christ envied him not, but himself went out to be baptized of him in Jordan, though he was John's Lord and Master, and John, as he himself testified, had need to be baptized of him. And so far was he from begrudging to his disciples any honors or privileges as too great for them, that he told and promised them, John 14:12, that after his death and ascension they should do greater works than he had done while he remained with them. And as we find in the Acts of the Apostles, all that he foretold in a little while came true. Number 3. The true spirit of Christian love will dispose us to yield to the authority of these precepts and to the influence of the motives enforcing them. And the spirit of love will dispose us to this directly or by its immediate tendency, and indirectly as it teaches and leads us to humility. First, Christian love disposes us to hearken to the precepts that forbid envy and to the gospel motives against it by its own immediate tendency. The nature of charity or Christian love to men is directly contrary to envy, for love does not grudge, but rejoices at the good of those who are loved. And surely love to our neighbor does not dispose us to hate him for his prosperity or be unhappy at his good. And love to God also has a direct tendency to influence us to obey his commands. The natural, genuine, uniform fruit of love to God is obedience, and therefore it will tend to obedience to those commands in which he forbids envy as much as others, yea, to them more especially, because love delights to obey no commands so much as those that require love. And so love to God will dispose us to follow his example, in that he has not begrudged us our manifold blessings, but has rejoiced in our enjoyment, and will dispose us to imitate the example of Christ, in not begrudging his life for our sakes, and to imitate the example he set us in the whole course of his life on earth. Second, a spirit of Christian love disposes to the same also indirectly by inclining us to humility. It is pride that is a great root and source of envy. It is because of the pride of men's hearts that they have such a burning desire to be distinguished and to be superior to all others in honor and prosperity, and which makes them so uneasy and dissatisfied in seeing others above them. But a spirit of love tends to mortify pride and to work humility in the heart. Love to God tends to this, as it implies a sense of God's infinite excellence, and therefore tends to a sense of our comparative nothingness and unworthiness. And love to men tends to a humble behavior among men, as it disposes us to acknowledge the excellencies of others, and that the honors bestowed on them are their due, and to esteem them better than ourselves, and thus more deserving of distinction than we are. But I will not now dwell more particularly on this point, as in a future lecture I shall have occasion more fully to show how Christian love tends to humility. Passing then, in conclusion, to the application of the subject, I remark, first, it should lead us to examine ourselves whether we are in any degree under the influence of an envious spirit. Let us examine ourselves as to time past, and look over our past behavior among men. Many of us have long been members of human society, having lived by others, and having had to do with them in very many ways, and being connected with them on many occasions, both in public and private affairs. And we have seen others in prosperity, and it may be prospering in their affairs more than ourselves. They have had more of the world, and have had been possessed of greater riches, and have lived in a greater ease and in much more honorable circumstances than we have enjoyed. And perhaps some that heretofore we used to look upon as our equals or even as inferiors, we may have seen growing in wealth or advancing in honor and prosperity, while we have been left behind, until now they have reached a station far superior to our own. It may be that we have seen such changes and been called to bear such trials through a great part of the course of our life, and certainly we have often seen others abounding in all that the world esteems of value, while we have been comparatively destitute of these things. And now let us inquire how these things have affected us, and how have our hearts stood, and what has been our behavior in these circumstances. Has there not been a great deal of uneasiness, dissatisfaction, and uncomfortable feeling, and of a desire to see those who were prosperous brought down? Have we not been glad to hear of anything to their disadvantage? And in the forebodings we have expressed about them, have we not in reality spoken out our wishes, and in word or deed have we not been ready to do that which might in some respect lessen their prosperity or honor? Have we ever cherished a bitter or unkind spirit toward another because of his prosperity, or have been ready on account of it to look upon him with an evil eye, or to oppose him in public affairs, or from an envious spirit to act with the party that might be against him? As we look back on the past, do we not see that in these and many other kindred things we have often exercised and allowed an envious spirit? And many times have not our hearts burned with it toward others? And turning from the past to the present, what spirit do you now find as you search your heart? Do you carry any old grudge in your heart against this or that man that you see sitting with you from Sabbath to Sabbath in the house of God, and from time to time sitting with you at the Lord's table? Is not the prosperity of one and another an eyesore to you? And does it not make your life uncomfortable that they are higher than you? And would it not be truly a comfort to you to see them brought down, so that their losses and depression would be a source of inward joy and gladness to your heart? And does not this same spirit lead you often to think evil, or speak with contempt or unkindness or severity of such to those about you? And let those who are above others in prosperity inquire whether they do not allow and exercise a spirit of opposition to the comparative happiness of those below them. Is there not a disposition in you to pride yourself on being above them, and a desire that they should not rise higher, lest they come to be equal or superior to you? And from this, are you not willing to see them brought down, and even to help them down to the utmost, lest at some time they may get above you? And does not all this show that you are very much under the influence of an envious spirit? But it may be that in all this you may justify yourself, not giving it the name of envy, but some other name, and having various excuses for your envious spirit, by which you account yourself justified in its exercise. Some are ready to say of others that they are not worthy of the honor and prosperity they have, that they have not half the fitness or worthiness of the honor and advancement they have as many others of their neighbors who are below them. And where, I ask, is a man in the world who envies another for his honor or prosperity, but is ready to think or say that that other is not worthy of his prosperity and honors? Did Joseph's brethren esteem him worthy of the peculiar love of his father? Did Haman think Mordecai worthy of the honor the king conferred on him? Or did the Jews think the Gentiles worthy of the privileges extended to them under the gospel, when they were so filled with envy on this account, as is related in the Acts of the Apostles, chapter 13:45 and 17:5? It is generally the case that when others are promoted to honor, or in any respect come to remarkable prosperity, some are always ready to improve the occasion to tell of their faults and set forth their unworthiness, to rake up all possible evil about them. Whereas it is not so much that they have faults, for these would often be unnoticed if they were in obscurity, as it is that they are prospered. And those who talk about their faults are envious of their prosperity, and therefore speak against them. And I would desire such persons to think that they are to be justified in their opposition to others because they are not worthy of their prosperity, diligently to inquire which it is that pains and troubles them most, their neighbor's faults or their prosperity. If it be their faults, then you would be grieved on account of them, whether the persons were prospered or not. And if truly grieved with their faults, then you would be very slow to speak of them except to themselves, and then in the true spirit of Christian compassion and friendship. But you may say, they make a bad use of their prosperity and honor, that they are lifted up by it, and cannot bear or do not know how to manage it, that they are insufferable and scornful, and there is no doing anything with them in their prosperity, and it is best that they should be brought down, that this will tend to humble them, and that the best thing for their own good is to bring them down to the place where they belong and which is fittest for them. But here let me urge you strictly to inquire whether you do in truth lament the injury their prosperity does them, and whether you mourn it for their sakes and because you love them. Do your lamentations spring from pity or from envy? If you dislike their prosperity because it is not best for them but does them hurt, then you will grieve for their calamity and not at their prosperity. You will sincerely love them, and out of this love will be heartily sorry for their calamity, and feel a true compassion of heart for them, that the disadvantages of their prosperous state are so much greater than its advantages. But is this in truth your real feeling? Do not deceive yourself. Is it their calamity that you are grieved at, or is it merely that they are prospered? Is it that you are grieved for them that their prosperity injures them, or for yourself that their prosperity is not yours? And here also let everyone inquire whether they do not sometimes envy others for their spiritual prosperity. You remember what was the spirit of Cain toward Abel, of the seed of the serpent toward the seed of the woman, of Ishmael toward Isaac, of the Jews toward Christ, of the elder brother toward the prodigal. Beware that you cherish not their spirit, but rather rejoice in the good estate of others as much as if it were your own. Number 2. The subject also exhorts us to disallow and put away everything approaching to an envious spirit. So contrary is a spirit of envy to a Christian spirit, so evil in itself, and so injurious to others, that it should be disallowed and put away by all, and especially by those who profess to be Christians. Great numbers cherish the hope that this is their character, and that they have been endued with a new spirit, even the spirit of Christ. Let it then be evident to all that such is your spirit by the exercise of that charity that envieth not. In the language of the Apostle James, chapter 3, 13-16, who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show it out of a good conversation, his works with meekness of wisdom. But if you have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envy and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. The spirit of envy is the very contrary of the spirit of heaven, where all rejoice in the happiness of others, and it is the very spirit of hell itself, which is a most hateful spirit, and one that feeds itself on the ruin of the prosperity and happiness of others, on which account some have compared envious persons to caterpillars, which delight most in devouring the most flourishing trees and plants. And as an envious disposition is most hateful in itself, so it is most uncomfortable and uneasy to its possessor. As it is the disposition of the devil and partakes of his likeness, so it is the disposition of hell and partakes of its misery. In the strong language of Solomon in Proverbs 14:30, a sound heart is the life of the flesh, but envy is the rottenness of the bones. It is like a powerful eating cancer, preying on the vitals, offensive and full of corruption, and it is the most foolish kind of self-injury, for the envious make themselves trouble most needlessly, being uncomfortable only because of others' prosperity, when that prosperity does not injure themselves or diminish their enjoyments and blessings. But they are not willing to enjoy what they have because others are enjoying also. Let then the consideration of the foolishness, the baseness, the infamy of so wicked a spirit cause us to abhor it and to shun its excuses, and earnestly to seek the spirit of Christian love, that excellent spirit of divine charity, which will lead us always to rejoice in the welfare of others, and which will fill our own hearts with happiness. This love is of God, 1 John 4:7, and he that dwelleth in it dwelleth in God, and God in him, 1 John 4:16. Chapter 7. The spirit of charity is an humble spirit. Charity vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly, 1 Corinthians 13:4-5. Having shown the nature and tendency of charity or Christian love in respect to our receiving injury and doing good to others, that it suffers long and is kind, and also with respect to the good possessed by others as compared with that possessed by ourselves, that charity envieth not, The apostle now proceeds to show that in reference to what we ourselves may be or have, charity is not proud, that it vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up, doth not behave itself unseemly. As on the one hand it prevents us from envying others what they possess, so on the other it keeps us from glorying in what we possess ourselves. Paul had just declared that charity was contrary to a spirit of envy, and now he declares that it is equally contrary to that spirit which especially provokes men to envy others, in which they often make a pretense or apology for envying them, namely, that they are puffed up with their honors and prosperity, and vaunt themselves on their possession of these things. When men have obtained prosperity or are advanced, and others observe that they are puffed up and vaunt themselves in it, this tends to provoke envy and make others uneasy at the sight of their prosperity. But if a man has prosperity or advancement, and yet does not vaunt himself or behave in an unseemly manner on account of it, this tends to reconcile others to his high circumstances and make them satisfied that he should enjoy his elevation. As already observed, when men envy another, they are prone to excuse and justify themselves in so doing by the pretense that he does not make a good improvement of his prosperity, but is proud of it and puffed up on account of it. But the apostle shows how Christian love or charity tends to make all behave suitably to their condition, whatever it may be. If below others, not to envy them, and if above others, not to be proud or puffed up with the prosperity. In the words of the text, we may observe that a spirit of Christian love is spoken of as the opposite of a proud behavior, and that two degrees of such a behavior are mentioned. The higher degree is expressed by a man's vaunting himself, that is, by his so carrying himself as to show plainly that he glories in what he has or is, and the lower degree is expressed by his behaving himself unseemly, that is, by his not conducting himself in a becoming and decent manner in the enjoyment of his prosperity, but so acting as to show that he thinks the mere fact of his being prosperous exalts him above others. And the spirit of charity or love is spoken of as opposed not only to a proud behavior, but to a proud spirit, pride in the heart, for charity is not puffed up. The doctrine we are taught then in these words is this, that the spirit of charity or Christian love is an humble spirit. In speaking to this doctrine, I would show, 1, what humility is, and 2, how a Christian spirit or the spirit of charity is an humble spirit. 1, I would show what humility is. Humility may be defined to be a habit of mind and heart, corresponding to our comparative unworthiness and vileness before God, or a sense of our own comparative meanness in His sight, with the disposition to a behavior answerable thereto. It consists partly in the understanding, or in the thought and knowledge we have of ourselves, partly in the will, partly in the sense or estimate we have of ourselves, and partly in the disposition we have to behavior answerable to this sense or estimate. And the first thing in humility is a sense of our own comparative meanness. I say comparative meanness because humility is a grace proper for beings that are glorious and excellent in very many respects. Thus the saints and angels in heaven excel in humility, and humility is proper and suitable in them, though they are pure, spotless, and glorious beings, perfect in holiness and excelling in mind and strength. But though they are thus glorious, yet they have a comparative meanness before God of which they are sensible. For he has said in Psalm 113:6, to humble himself to behold the things that are in heaven. So the man Christ Jesus, who is the most excellent and glorious of all creatures, is yet meek and lowly of heart, and excels all other beings in humility. Humility is one of the excellencies of Christ, because he is not only God, but man, and as man he was humble. For humility is not, and cannot be, an attribute of the divine nature. God's nature is indeed infinitely opposite to pride, and yet humility cannot properly be predicated of him, for if it could, this would argue imperfection, which is impossible in God. God, who is infinite in excellence and glory, and infinitely above all things, cannot have any comparative meanness, and of course cannot have any such comparative meanness to be sensible of, and therefore cannot be humble. But humility is an excellence proper to all created intelligent beings, for they are all infinitely little and mean before God, and most of them are in some way mean and low in comparison with some of their fellow creatures. Humility implies a compliance with that rule of the apostle in Romans 12:3, that we think not of ourselves more highly than we ought to think, but that we think soberly, according as God hath dealt to every one of us a measure, not only of faith, but of other things. And this humility, as a virtue in man, implies a sense of their own comparative meanness, both as compared with God and as compared with their fellow creatures. First, humility doth primarily and chiefly consist in a sense of our meanness as compared with God, or a sense of the infinite distance there is between God and ourselves. We are little despicable creatures, even worms of the dust, and we should feel that we are as nothing and less than nothing in comparison with the majesty of heaven and earth. Such a sense of his nothingness Abraham expressed when he said in Genesis 18:27, "Behold, now I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes." There is no true humility without somewhat of this spirit, for however sensible we may be of our meanness as compared with some of our fellow creatures, we are not truly humble unless we have a sense of our nothingness as compared with God. Some have a low thought of themselves as compared with other men, from the meanness of their circumstances, or from a melancholy and desponding temperament, which is natural to them, or from some other cause. While still they know nothing of the infinite distance there is between them and God, and though they may be ready to look upon themselves as humble-spirited, yet they have no true humility. That which above all other things it concerns us to know of ourselves is what we are in comparison with God, who is our Creator, and the one in whom we live and move and have our being, and who is infinitely perfect in all things. And if we are ignorant of our meanness as compared with him, then the most essential thing in that which is indispensable in true humility is lacking. But where this is truly felt, there arises from it, secondly, a sense of our own meanness as compared with many of our fellow creatures. For man is not only a mean creature in comparison with God, but he is very mean as compared with multitudes of creatures of a superior rank in the universe. And most men are mean in comparison with many of their fellow men. And when a sense of this comparative meanness arises from a just sense of our meanness as God sees it, then it is of the nature of true humility. He that hath the right sense and estimate of himself in comparison with God will be likely to have his eyes open to see himself aright in all respects. Seeing truly how he stands with respect to the first and highest of all beings will tend greatly to help him to a just apprehension of the place he stands in among creatures. And he that does not rightly know the first and greatest of beings, who is the fountain and source of all other beings, cannot truly know anything aright. But so far as he has come to a knowledge of the former, so far as he prepared for and led to the knowledge of other things, and so of himself as related to others and as standing among them. All this would apply to men considered as unfallen beings, and would have been true of our race if our first parents had not fallen and thus involved their posterity in sin. But humility in fallen men implies a sense of a tenfold meanness both before God and men. Man's natural meanness consists in his being infinitely below God in natural perfection, and in God's being infinitely above him in greatness, power, wisdom, majesty, and so on. And a truly humble man is sensible of the small extent of his own knowledge and the great extent of his ignorance and of the small extent of his understanding as compared with the understanding of God. He is sensible of his weakness, how little his strength is and how little he is able to do. He is sensible of his natural distance from God, of his dependence on him, of the insufficiency of his own power and wisdom, and that it is by God's power that he is upheld and provided for, and that he needs God's wisdom to lead and guide him, and his might to enable him to do what he ought to do for him. He is sensible of his subjection to God, and that God's greatness does properly consist in his authority, in which he is the sovereign Lord and King over all, and he is willing to be subject to that authority, is feeling that it becomes him to submit to the divine will and yield in all things to God's authority. Man had this sort of comparative littleness before the fall. He was then infinitely little and mean in comparison with God, but his natural meanness has become much greater since the fall, for the moral ruin of his nature has greatly impaired his natural faculties, though it has not extinguished them. The truly humble man, since the fall, is also sensible of his moral meanness and vileness. This consists in his sinfulness. His natural meanness is his littleness as a creature. His moral meanness is his vileness and filthiness as a sinner. And fallen man was infinitely distant from God in his natural qualities or attributes. Fallen man is infinitely distant from him also as sinful and thus filthy. And a truly humble person is in some measure sensible of his comparative meanness in this respect, that he sees how exceedingly polluted he is before an infinitely holy God, in whose sight the heavens are nigh clean. He sees how pure God is, and how filthy and abominable he is before him. Such a sense of his comparative meanness Isaiah had when he saw God's glory and cried out in Isaiah 6:5, "Woe is me, for I am undone, because I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for mine eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts." An humble sense of our meanness in this respect implies self-abhorrence, such as led Job to exclaim, in Job 42:5-6, "I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Wherefore I abhor myself, and repent in dust and ashes." It implies also such contrition and brokenness of heart as David speaks of when he says in Psalm 51:17, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise." And such too as Isaiah contemplated when he declared, in Isaiah 57:15, "Thus saith the high and lofty one that inhabiteth eternity, whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit, to revive the spirit of the humble and to revive the heart of the contrite ones." And both the sense of our own littleness and the sense of our moral vileness before God are implied in that poverty of spirit which the Savior speaks of when he says in Matthew 5:3, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And in order to the sense of our own meanness and unworthiness that is implied in humility, it is not only necessary that we should know God and have a sense of his greatness, without which we cannot know ourselves, but we must have a right sense also of his excellence and loveliness. The devils and damned spirits see a great deal of God's greatness, of his wisdom, omnipotence, and so on. God makes them sensible of it by what they see in his dealings and feel in their own sufferings. However unwilling they are to know it, God makes them know how much he is above them now, and they shall know and feel it still more at and after the judgment. But they have no humility, nor will they ever have, because though they see and feel God's greatness, yet they see and feel nothing of his loveliness. And without this, there can be no true humility, for that cannot exist unless the creature feels his distance from God, not only with respect to his greatness, but also his loveliness. The angels and ransomed spirits in heaven see both these things, not only how much greater God is than they are, but how much more lovely he also is, so that though they have no absolute defilement and filthiness as fallen men have, yet as compared with God it is said in Job 15:15 and 4:18, "The heavens are not clean in his sight, and his angels he charged with folly." From such a sense of their comparative meanness, persons are made sensible how unworthy they are of God's mercy or gracious notice. Such a sense Jacob expressed when he said in Genesis 32:10, "I am not worthy of the least of all the mercies, and of all the truth which thou hast showed unto thy servant." And David, when he exclaimed, 2 Samuel 7:18, "Who am I, O Lord God, and what is my house, that thou hast brought me hitherto?" In such a sense have we all who are truly humble before God. But as humility consists in a sense of our comparative meanness, so it implies, secondly, a disposition to a corresponding behavior and conduct. Without this, there is no true humility. If it could be so that our understanding could be enlightened to see our own meanness, and at the same time the will and disposition of the soul did not comply with and conform to that which is answerable to our sense of it, but opposed it, then there would be no humility. As was just now said, the devils and damned spirits see much of their comparative littleness before God in some respects. They know that God is infinitely above them in power and knowledge and majesty, and yet, not knowing and feeling his loveliness and excellence, their wills and dispositions by no means comply with and conform to what is becoming their meanness. And so they have no humility, but are full of pride. Without pretending to mention everything in our behavior answerable to a proper sense of our meanness and vileness to which humility would dispose us, for that would include the whole of our duty toward God and man, I would specify some things that are worthy of notice, both in reference to God and in reference to man. First, some things in our behavior toward God to which humility will dispose us. As the first of these, humility disposes a person heartily and freely to acknowledge his meanness or littleness before God. He sees how fit and suitable it is that he should do this, and he does it willingly and even with delight. He freely confesses his own nothingness and vileness, and owns himself unworthy of any mercy and deserving of all misery. It is the disposition of the humble soul to lie low before God and to humble himself in the dust in his presence. Humility also disposes one to be distrustful of himself and to depend only on God. The proud man that has a high opinion of his own wisdom or strength or righteousness is self-confident. But the humble are not disposed to trust in themselves, but are diffident of their own sufficiency, and it is their disposition to rely on God and with delight to cast themselves wholly on him as a refuge in righteousness and strength. The humble man is further disposed to renounce all the glory of the good he has or does and to give it all to God. If there be anything that is good in him, or any good done by him, it is not his disposition to glory or vaunt himself in it before God, but to ascribe all to God, and in the language of the psalmist, in Psalm 115, verse 1, to say, "Not unto us, O Lord, not unto us, but unto thy name give glory, for thy mercy and thy truth's sake." It is a disposition, again, of the humble person wholly to subject himself to God. His heart is not opposed to a full and absolute subjection to the divine will, but inclined to it. He is disposed to be subject to the commands and laws of God, for he sees it to be right and best that he who is so infinitely inferior to God should be thus subject, and that it is an honor that belongs to God to reign over and give laws to him. And he is equally disposed to be subject to the providence and daily disposal of God, and to submit cheerfully to his will, is manifested in what he orders for him. And though God orders affliction and low and depressed circumstances as his lot in the world, he does not murmur. But feeling his meanness and unworthiness, he is sensible that afflictive and trying dispensations are what he deserves, and that his circumstances are better than he merits. And however dark the divine dealings with the faith which we so often see manifested in those who are eminent in grace, he is ready to say with Job in Job 13:15, "Though he slay me, yet will I trust in him." And as humility implies a disposition to such a behavior toward God, so secondly, it disposes to a behavior toward men answerable to our comparative meanness. And this I will show by pointing out what kind of behavior humility tends to prevent. And it tends in the first place, to prevent an aspiring and ambitious behavior amongst men. The man that is under the influence of an humble spirit is content with such a situation amongst men as God is pleased to allot to him, and is not greedy of honor, and does not affect to appear uppermost and exalted above his neighbors. He acts on the principle of that saying of the prophet in Jeremiah 45:5, "Seekest thou great things for thyself? Seek them not." And also of that injunction of the Apostle in Romans 12:16, "Mind not high things." Humility tends also to prevent an ostentatious behavior. If the truly humble man has any advantage or benefit of any kind, either temporal or spiritual, above his neighbors, he will not affect to make a show of it. If he has greater natural abilities than others, he will not be forward to parade and display them, or be careful that others shall know his superiority in this respect. If he has a remarkable spiritual experience, he will not be solicitous that men should know it for the sake of the honor he may obtain by it. Nor does he affect to be esteemed of men as an eminent saint and a faithful servant of heaven, for it is a small thing with him what men may think of him. If he does anything well, or does his duty in any respect with difficulty and self-denial, he does not affect that men should take notice of it, nor is he careful lest they should not observe it. He is not of the behavior of the Pharisees, who, it is said in Matthew 23:5, did all their works to be seen of men. But if he has done anything in sincerity, he is content that the great being, who sees in secret, beholds and will approve it. Humility tends also to prevent an arrogant and assuming behavior. He that is under the influence of an humble spirit is not forward to take too much upon him. And when he is amongst others, he does not carry it towards them as if he expected and insisted that a great deal of regard should be shown to himself. His behavior does not carry with it the idea that he is the best amongst those about him, that he is the one to whom the chief regard should be shown and whose judgment is most to be sought and followed. He does not carry it as if he expected that everybody should bow and truckle to him and give place to him, as if no one was of much consequence as himself. He does not put on assuming airs in his common conversation, nor in the management of his business, nor in the duties of religion. He is not forward to take upon himself that which does not belong to him, as though he had power where indeed he has not, as if the earth ought to be subject to his bidding and must comply with his inclination and purposes. On the contrary, he gives all due deference to the judgment and inclinations of others, and his behavior carries with it the impression that he sincerely receives and acts on that teaching of the Apostle in Philippians 2:3. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but in lowliness of mind let each esteem other better than themselves. In talking of the things of religion, he is not the heir, either in his speech or behavior, of one that esteems himself one of the best saints in the whole company, but he rather carries himself as if he thought in the expression of the Apostle, in Ephesians 3:8, that he was less than the least of all saints. Humility tends also to prevent a scornful behavior. Treating others with scorn and contempt is one of the worst and most offensive manifestations of pride toward them. But they that are under the influence of a humble spirit are far from such a behavior. They do not despise or look down on those that are below them with a haughty, supercilious air, as though they were scarce worthy to come nigh them or to have any regard from them. They are sensible that there is no such vast difference between themselves and their fellow men as warrants such a behavior. They are not found treating with scorn and contempt what others say, or speaking of what they do with ridicule and sneering reflections, or sitting and relating what others may have spoken or done, only to make sport of it. On the contrary, humility disposes a person to a condescending behavior to the meekest and lowest, and to treat inferiors with courtesy and affability, as being sensible of his own weakness and despicableness before God, and that it is God alone that makes him in any respect to differ from others or gives him the advantage over them. The truly humble will, Romans 12:16, always have the spirit to condescend to men of low estate, even if they are great men, and in places of public trust and honor. Humility will dispose them to treat their inferiors in such a manner as has been spoken of, and not in a haughty and scornful manner, as vaunting themselves on their greatness. Humility tends also to prevent a willful and stubborn behavior. They that are under the influence of a humble spirit will not set up their own will either in public or private affairs. They will not be stiff and inflexible and insist that everything must go according to what they happen first to propose, and manifest a disposition by no means to be easy, but to make all the difficulty they can, and to make others uneasy as well as themselves, and to prevent anything being done with any quietness, if it be not according to their own mind and will. They are not as some that the Apostle Peter describes in 2 Peter 2:10, presumptuous and self-willed, always bent on carrying their own points, and if this cannot be done, then bent on opposing and annoying others. On the contrary, humility disposes men to be of a yielding spirit to others, ready for the sake of peace, and to gratify others, to comply in many things with their inclinations, and to yield to their judgments wherein they are not inconsistent with truth and holiness. A truly humble man is inflexible in nothing but in the cause of his Lord and Master, which is the cause of truth and virtue. In this he is inflexible because God and conscience require it, but in things of lesser moment and which do not involve his principles as a follower of Christ, and in things that only concern his own private interests, he is apt to yield to others. And if he sees that others are stubborn and unreasonable in their willfulness, he does not allow that to provoke him to be stubborn and willful in his opposition to them, but he rather acts on the principles taught in such passages as Romans 12:19, 1 Corinthians 6:7, and Matthew 5:40-41. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourselves, but rather give place unto wrath. Why do you not rather take wrong? Why do you not rather suffer yourselves to be defrauded? If any man will sue thee at the law and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. And whosoever shall compel thee to go a mile, go with him twain.